It is the 3rd of April, and springtime is in full force. We are in Rome, which in this year of 1455 is neither the glorious world capital it had been under the emperors of old, nor the great city it will become once again in a few generations. Instead, it is a dilapidated backwater of 30 or perhaps 40,000 souls. At the Vatican, dominated by the thousand-year-old and slowly disintegrating St. Peter's Basilica, the cardinals are assembling. They are doing so because 10 days have passed since the death of Pope Nicholas V, of apoplexy, the attending physicians have declared, thereby revealing that they haven't the faintest idea of what it was that caused him to grow feebler week after week, until finally, aged only 57, he himself announced that his end was at hand. The death of this particular pontiff at this particular time is a deeply worrisome thing. As for the fact that the time has come to elect his successor, it is so snarled up in difficulties and dangers as to scarcely bear thinking about. Officially, and as usual, the first 9 days after the Pope's death were reserved for the obsequies, with which deceased pontiffs are launched into the afterlife. One requiem mass per day, each presided over by a different cardinal. But in fact, and inevitably, the days and the nights as well have been filled with backstairs politicking, mainly to see who can put together the most potent blocks of votes. In the midst of all this, Nicholas's wizened little body has been sealed up in the traditional three coffins, one of Cyprus, inside another of lead, inside still another of fine-grained and polished elm. It was then laid to rest in the crypt under the basilica, a structure so alarmingly decrepit that in the last few years of the Pope's reign, 2,500 cartloads of stone have been stripped from the Colosseum and hauled across the Tiber for use in shoring it up. By the time the last Ite Missa Est brought the last Mass to an end, the windows of one wing of the pontifical palace were boarded up in the customary way. Austere little cells, each containing a cot, a stool, and a small table, have been hammered together inside. The 15 available cardinals, 6 others are too far from Rome to attend, are now reporting for duty. As they file inside, the doors are bolted behind them. Guards are posted, and the conclave of 1455 is formally in session. Deprived of natural light, the cardinals are dependent on candles and oil lamps for illumination. With no ventilation and wood fires the only source of morning warmth, the air they breathe will soon be foul. But conclaves are not supposed to be pleasant. Physical discomfort long ago proved its value. It encourages the princes of the church to get on with their business, announce the results, and go home. Every part of the process is governed by customs that have evolved over a millennium and a half. At various times, the choosing of popes has been under the control of Roman emperors, Byzantine emperors, and Holy Roman emperors from beyond the Alps. Sometimes popes have been able to nominate their successors, and there have been periods when no one would dare take the throne without the approval of the clergy, even the people of Rome. But in 1059, a papal decree conferred the right of election on the College of Cardinals. 80 years later, another decree gave that right to the cardinals exclusively, meaning that no further approvals were needed once the Sacred College had made its choice. 40 years after that, a 2/3 majority of votes cast became necessary for election. With that, the pattern was set. Though there have been other changes, an attempt, for example, to force fast action by reducing the cardinals' rations if they failed to reach a decision within 3 days, and reducing them again if a pope has not been elected after 5. The essential rules could hardly be simpler. Whoever can get the votes of 10 of the men now locked together inside the palace will assume the full powers of the papacy from the moment of his election. He will do so even if the whole outside world disapproves.